Physical attractiveness. What do you look for in a potential date? Sincerity? Good looks? Character? Conversational ability? Asked to rank such attributes, most intellectuals put physical attractiveness near the bottom of the list. Of course. Sophisticated, intelligent people are not greatly concerned with such superficial qualities as good looks. They know that beauty is only skin deep. At least they know that's how they ought to feel. As Cicero counseled, the final good and the supreme duty of the wise man is to resist appearance. This intuition that looks matter little may be another instance of our denying real influences upon us. For there is now a file drawer full of research studies indicating that appearance is a powerful determinant of initial attraction. The consistency and pervasiveness of this effect is startling, perhaps even disconcerting. Good looks are a great asset. Like it or not, the fact is that a young woman's physical attractiveness is a moderately good predictor of how frequently she dates. A young man's attractiveness, slightly less a predictor of how frequently he dates. Does this simply imply, as many have surmised, that women are better at following Cicero's advice to resist appearance? Or does it merely reflect the fact that men more often do the inviting? If women were to indicate their preferences among various men, some researchers have addressed this question by providing men and women students with various pieces of information about someone of the other sex, including a picture of the person, or by briefly introducing a man and a woman and later asking them how interested they would be in dating one another. In these experiments, women were virtually as much influenced by a man's looks as men were by a woman's. Do the benefits of being good-looking spring entirely from one's being sexually attractive? Clearly not. Young children are favorably biased toward attractive children, much as adults are biased toward attractive adults. When adults judge children, they are similarly biased. Margaret Clifford and Elaine Hatfield showed Missouri fifth grade teachers identical information about a boy or girl, but with the photograph of an attractive or unattractive child attached. The teachers who judged an attractive child saw the child as more intelligent and more likely to do well in school. Or think of yourself as a playground supervisor having to discipline an unruly child. Might you be tempted to give more benefit of the doubt if the child is attractive? What is more, beautiful people, even if of the same sex, are assumed also to possess certain desirable traits. Other things being equal, they are guessed to be happier, more intelligent, more sociable, more successful, and more competent. When in need, they receive more help. When good things happen, for example, a promotion, attractive people are perceived as more responsible for the outcome than are unattractive people. When bad things happen, attractive people are seen as less responsible. To top it off, attractive people, more than unattractive people, are guessed to have personalities like one's own. Added together, the findings point to a physical attractiveness stereotype. What is beautiful is good. Children are taught the stereotype quite early. Snow White and Cinderella are beautiful and kind. The witch and the stepsisters are ugly and wicked. As one kindergarten girl put it when asked what it means to be pretty, it's like being a princess. Everybody loves you. However, we should not overstate the potency of the attractiveness stereotype. To say that attractiveness is important, other things being equal, is not to say that physical appearance is always more important than other qualities. Attractiveness probably most affects first impressions. One's appearance is vivid, it draws immediate attention. As a relationship develops, appearance may diminish in importance. Nevertheless, first impressions are important, not only for one's prospects for dating, but also for job interviews. If first impressions are bad, there may never be a chance for second impressions. Indications are that attractiveness does figure strongly in hiring decisions. Moreover, as society has seemingly become more mobile and urbanized, our contacts with doctors, colleagues, and neighbors more fleeting, first impressions have probably become more important than ever before. Is the physical attractiveness stereotype accurate? Or was Leo Tolstoy correct when he wrote that it's a strange illusion to suppose that beauty is goodness? There might well be a trace of truth to the stereotype. Children and young adults who are attractive tend to have higher self-esteem. They are more assertive, though they are also believed to be more egotistical. They are neither more nor less academically capable, contrary to the negative stereotype that beauty times brains equals a constant. However, they are somewhat more socially polished. Thus far, I have described attractiveness as if it were an objective quality, like height, something some people have more of, some less. Actually, attractiveness is whatever the people of any given place and time find attractive. This, of course, varies. And even in a given place and time, there is, fortunately, some disagreement about who's attractive and who's not. Generally, though, attractive facial and bodily features do not deviate too drastically from the average. Noses, legs, or statures that are not unusually large or small tend to be perceived as relatively attractive. We can conclude our discussion of attractiveness on a heartwarming note. Not only do we perceive attractive people as likable, but we also perceive likable people as physically attractive. Perhaps you can recall individuals who, as you grew to like them, became more attractive, their physical imperfections no longer so noticeable. For example, Alan Gross and Christine Crofton had University of Missouri students view someone's photograph after reading a favorable or unfavorable description of the person's personality. Those perceived as good appeared more attractive. Other researchers have found that the more in love a woman is with a man, the more physically attractive she finds him. Apparently, Plato was right. The good is the beautiful. New words. Academically. Assertive. Attractiveness. Consistency. Conversational. Determinant. Deviate. Disconcerting. Drastically. Favorable. Favorably. Heartwarming. Imperfection. Likable. Moderately. Overstate. Pervasiveness. Polished. Sexually. Sincerity. Startling. Stature. Stepsister. Surmise. Unfavorable. Unruly. Urbanize. Wicked.
Dress for success. Since I had very early on discovered that the socioeconomic value of a man's clothing is important in determining his credibility with certain groups, his ability to attract certain kinds of women, and his acceptance to the business community, one of the first elements I undertook to research was the socioeconomic level of all items of clothing. Take the raincoat, for example. Most raincoats sold in this country are either beige or black. Those are the two standard colors. Intuitively, I felt that the beige raincoat was worn generally by the upper middle class and black by the lower middle class. First, I visited several Fifth Avenue stores that cater almost exclusively to upper middle class customers. and attempted to ascertain the number of beige raincoats versus black raincoats being sold. The statistical breakdown was approximately 4-1 in favor of beige. I then checked stores on the lower middle class level and found that almost the reverse statistic applied. They sold 4 black raincoats to each beige raincoat. This indicated that in all probability my feeling was correct. But recognizing that there were many variables that could discredit such preliminary research, I set the second stage in motion. On rainy days, I hired responsible college students to stand outside subway stations in determinable low-middle-class neighborhoods and outside determinable upper-middle-class suburban commuter stations, all in the New York area. The students merely counted the number of beige and black raincoats. My statistics held up at approximately 4-1 in either case, and I could now say that in the New York area, the upper middle class generally wore beige raincoats and the lower middle class generally wore black ones. My next step was to take a rainy day count in 2 different socioeconomic areas in Chicago, Los Angeles, Dallas, Atlanta, and 6 equally widespread small towns. The research again held up. Statistics came back from the cities at about 4-1, and from the small towns at about 2.5 to 3-1. The statistics were not quite that clear-cut, but averaged out into those ranges. From these statistics, I was able to state that in the United States, the beige raincoat is generally worn by members of the upper middle class, and the black raincoat generally worn by members of the lower middle class. From this, I was able to hypothesize that since these raincoats were an intrinsic part of the American environment, they had in all probability conditioned people by their predominance in certain classes, and automatic reactions could be expected. In short, when someone met a man in a beige raincoat, he was likely to think of him as a member of the upper middle class, and when he met a man in a black raincoat, he was likely to think of him as a member of the lower middle class. I then had to see if my hypothesis would hold up under testing. My first test was conducted with 1,362 people, a cross-section of the general public. They were given an extrasensory perception test, in which they were asked to guess the answers to a number of problems to which the solutions, they were told, could only be known through ESP. The percentage of correct answers would indicate their ESP quotient. Naturally, a participant in this type of test attempts to get the right answer every time and has no reason to lie, since he wants to score high. In this test, among a group of other problems and questions, I inserted a set of almost identical twin pictures. There was only one variable. The twin pictures showed the same man in the same pose, dressed in the same suit, the same shirt, the same tie, the same shoes. The only difference was the raincoat. One black, one beige. Participants were told that the pictures were of twin brothers and were asked to identify the more prestigious of the two. Over 87%, or 1,118 people, chose the man in the beige raincoat. I next ran a field test. 2 friends and I wore beige raincoats for 1 month and then switched to black raincoats the following month. We attempted to duplicate our other clothing during both months. At the end of each month, we recorded the general attitude of people toward us: waiters, store clerks, business associates, etc. all three of us agreed that the beige raincoat created a distinctly better impression upon the people we met. Finally, I conducted one additional experiment alone. Picking a group of business offices at random, I went into each office with a Wall Street Journal in a brown envelope and asked the receptionist or secretary to allow me to deliver it personally to the man in charge. When wearing a black raincoat, it took me a day and a half to deliver 25 papers. In a beige raincoat, I was able to deliver the same number in a single morning. The impression transmitted to recipients, receptionists, and secretaries by my black raincoat and a nondescript suit, shirt, and tie clearly was that I was a glorified delivery boy, and so I had to wait, or was never admitted. But their opinion of me was substantially altered by the beige raincoat worn with the same other clothes. They thought I might be an associate or friend of the boss, because that is what I implied, and they had better let me in. In short, they reacted to years of preconditioning and accepted the beige raincoat as a symbol of authority and status, while they rejected the black raincoat as such. The experiment will give you an idea of why I have spent so many years and so much money in determining what constitutes upper middle class dress. It is obvious from the experiment that secretaries and receptionists, who generally were not members of the upper middle class, did in fact recognize upper middle class clothing. If not consciously, then at least subconsciously, and they did react to it. Their reactions indicate that dress is neither trivial nor frivolous, but an essential element in helping a man to function in the business world with maximum effectiveness. But does everyone react as the secretaries did? For years, some companies have been attempting to increase the efficiency of employees by prescribing dress and establishing dress codes. Most of these schemes have proved ineffective because they have been created by amateurs who don't understand the effect clothing has on their work environment. Dress codes can work, but the assumption that clothing has a major, continuing impact on the wearer is erroneous. True, you may feel shabby when you wear shabby clothes, and your morale may perk up a bit when you splurge on an expensive tie. But clothing most significantly affects the people whom the wearer meets, and in the long run, affects the wearer only indirectly because it controls the reaction of the world to him. My research shows that in most business situations, the wearer is not directly affected by his clothing, and that the effect of clothing on other people is mainly controlled by the socioeconomic level of the clothing. Let me say it straight out. We all wear uniforms, and our uniforms are clear and distinct signs of class. We react to them accordingly. In almost any situation where two men meet, one man's clothing is saying to the other man, "I am more important than you are. Please show respect." Or, "I am your equal and expect to be treated as such." Or, "I am not your equal and I do not expect to be treated as such." New words. Amateur. Ascertain. Beige. Determinable. Discredit. Distinctly. Duplicate. Erroneous. Extrasensory. Extrasensory perception. Frivolous. Glorify. Hypothesis. Hypothesize. Ineffective. Intrinsic. intuitively. Neighborhood. Nondescript. Perk. Precondition. Predominance. Preliminary. Receptionist. Shabby. Splurge. Statistic. Statistics. Statistical. Subconsciously. Suburban. Versus.
Neat people versus sloppy people. I've finally figured out the difference between neat people and sloppy people. The distinction is, as always, moral. Neat people are lazier and meaner than sloppy people. Sloppy people, you see, are not really sloppy. Their sloppiness is merely the unfortunate consequence of their extreme moral sense. Sloppy people carry in their mind's eye a heavenly vision, a precise plan that is so great, so perfect, it can't be achieved in this world or the next. Sloppy people live in never-never land. Someday is their profession. Someday they are planning to alphabetize all their books and set up home catalogs. Someday they will go through their wardrobes and mark certain items for tentative mending and certain items for passing on to relatives of similar shape and size. Someday, sloppy people will make family scrapbooks into which they will put newspaper clippings, postcards, locks of hair, and the dried corsage from their senior prom. Someday, they will file everything on the surface of their desks, including the cash receipts from coffee purchases at the snack shop. Someday, they will sit down and read all the back issues of The New Yorker. For all these noble reasons and more, sloppy people never get neat. They aim too high and wide. They save everything, planning someday to file, order, and straighten out the world. But while these ambitious plans take clearer and clearer shape in their heads, the books spill from the shelves onto the floor. The clothes pile up in the laundry basket and closet. The family mementos accumulate in every drawer. The surface of the desk is buried under mounds of paper, and the unread magazines threaten to reach the ceiling. Sloppy people can't bear to part with anything. They give loving attention to every detail. When sloppy people say they're going to tackle the surface of the desk, they really mean it. Not a paper will go unturned. Not a rubber band will go unboxed. 4 hours or 2 weeks into the excavation, the desk looks exactly the same, primarily because the sloppy person is carefully creating new piles of papers with new headings and routinely stopping to read all the old book catalogs before he throws them away. A neat person would just clear off the desk. Neat people are not good at heart. They have cavalier attitudes toward possessions, including family heirlooms. Everything is just another dust catcher to them. If anything collects dust, it's got to go, and that's that. Neat people will toy with the idea of throwing the children out of the house, just to cut down on the clutter. Neat people don't care about process. They like results. What they want to do is get the whole thing over with, so they can sit down and watch TV. Neat people operate on two unvarying principles. Never handle any item twice and throw everything away. The only thing messy in a neat person's house is the trash can. The minute something comes to a neat person's hand, he will look at it, try to decide if it has immediate use, and, finding none, throw it in the trash. Neat people are especially vicious with mail. They never go through their mail unless they are standing directly over a trash can. If the trash can is beside the mailbox, even better. All ads, catalogs, pleas for charitable contributions, church bulletins, and money-saving coupons go straight into the trash can without being opened. All letters from home, postcards from Europe, bills and paychecks are opened, immediately responded to, then dropped in the trash can. Neat people keep their receipts only for tax purposes. That's it. No sentimental salvaging of birthday cards or the last letter a dying relative ever wrote. Into the trash can it goes. Neat people place neatness above everything, even economics. They are incredibly wasteful. Neat people throw away several toys every time they walk through the den. I knew a neat person once who threw away a perfectly good dish drainer because it had mold on it. The drainer was too much trouble to wash. And neat people sell their furniture when they move. Neat people are no good to borrow from. Neat people buy everything in expensive little single portions. They get their flour and sugar in 2-pound bags. They wouldn't consider clipping a coupon, saving a leftover, reusing plastic containers, or rinsing off tin foil and draping it over the dish drainer. You can never borrow a neat person's newspaper to see what's playing at the movies. Neat people have the paper all wadded up and in the trash by 7:05 a.m. Neat people remove everything that is in their way. People, animals, and things are all one to them. They are so insensitive. After they've finished with the pantry, the medicine cabinet, and the attic, they will throw out the red geranium, too many leaves, sell the dog, too many fleas, and send the children off to boarding school, too many footprints on the hardwood floors. New words: alphabetize, band, bulletin, bulletin, catalog, cavalier, charitable, clipping, closet, corsage, coupon, den, drainer, excavation, flea, foil, geranium, hardwood, heading, heirloom, memento, messy, plea, profession, reuse, rinse, salvage, sloppiness, unvarying, wad, wardrobe.
Turning boys into girls. I love Men's Health magazine. There, I've told you, and I'm not ashamed. My affection for Men's Health is driven by pure gender politics, by the realization that this magazine and a handful of others like it are evening things out in a way that Ms. can only dream of. With page after page of bulging biceps and masculine jaws, robust hairlines, and silken skin, men's health is advertising a standard of male beauty as stereotyped and unrealistic as the female version sold by those large-eyed, very young girls seen in the covers of Glamour and Elle. And with a variety of helpful features on foods that fight fat, banish your pot belly, and save your hair before it's too late, men's health is well on its way to making the male species as insane, insecure, and irrational about physical appearance as does any women's magazine. The days when men scrubbed their face with regular soap and viewed gray hair and wrinkles as a badge of honor are fading. Last year, international market analyst Euromonitor placed the U.S. men's toiletries market, hair color, skin moisturizer, tooth whiteners, etc., at $3.5 billion. According to a survey conducted by researchers for Men's Health in November 1996, approximately 20% of American men get manicures or pedicures. 18% use skin treatments such as masks or mud packs, and 10% enjoy professional facials. That same month, Psychology Today reported that a poll showed that 6% of men nationwide actually use traditionally female products to create the illusion of a youthful appearance. What men are putting on their bodies, however, is nothing compared with what they're doing to their bodies. While in the 1980s, only an estimated 1 in 10 plastic surgery patients were men, as of 1996, that ratio had shrunk to 1 in 5. The American Academy of Cosmetic Surgery estimates that nationwide, more than 690,000 men had cosmetic procedures performed in 1996. The most recent year for which figures are available. Granted, Men's Health and its journalistic cousins, Men's Journal, Details, etc., cannot take all the credit for this breakthrough in gender leveling. The fashion and glamour industries have perfected the art of creating consumer needs, and with the women's market pretty much saturated, men have become the obvious target by manufacturers and sellers of everything from masculine cosmetics to special clothing. Meanwhile, advances in medical science have made cosmetic surgery a quicker and safer option for busy executives. There are also underlying social factors. With women growing more financially independent, aspiring suitors are discovering that they must offer more than a full wallet if they expect to win and keep the fair young lady. Whatever combination of factors is causing the big increase of male vanity, magazines such as Men's Health provide the ideal meeting place for men's insecurities and marketers' greed. Like its more established female counterparts, Men's Health is an affordable, efficient delivery vehicle for the message that physical imperfection, age, and an underdeveloped fashion sense are potentially crippling disabilities. As with women's magazines, this cycle of insanity is self-perpetuating. The more men obsess about growing old or unattractive, the more marketers will exploit and expand that fear. The more marketers bombard men with messages about the need to be beautiful, the more they will obsess. Younger and younger men will also be drawn into this cycle of self-doubt. Having elevated men's physical insecurities to the level of a mental disorder. Men's magazines can then start doing what really matters, selling merchandise. On the cover of Men's Health each month, in small type, just above the magazine's title, appears the phrase, "Tons of useful stuff." Thumbing through an issue or two, however, one quickly realizes that a more accurate description would read, "Tons of expensive stuff." They're all there. Calvin Klein, Versace, Nike, Omega. The magazine even has those annoying little perfume strips, guaranteed to make your nose run and to alienate everyone within a 5-mile radius of you. Masters of psychology. Marketers use their sexiest messages and most popular male models to tempt or intimidate the readership of Men's Health. And just like in women's magazines, the articles themselves are designed to sell stuff. All those helpful tips for choosing blazers and ties and belts come complete with information on who, where, and how much. The strategy is brilliant. Make men understand exactly how far short of the ideal they fall. As Mark Janot, the grooming and health editor for Men's Journal, told Today Show host Matt Lauer, this is a huge, booming market. I mean, the marketers have found a group of people that are ripe for the picking. Men are finally learning that aging is a disease. To make all this girly image obsession acceptable to their audience, men's magazines employ all their creative energies to transform appearance issues into a guy thing. It appears that no matter how much skin lotion and hair gel you're trying to sell them, men must never suspect that you think they share women's insecurities. If you want a man to buy wrinkle cream, marketers have learned, you should encourage it as part of the usual masculine shaving routine. Aramis, for example, assures men that its popular Lift-Off moisture formula will help cut their shave time by 1/3. The biggest challenge for products started for women is how to transfer them to men, explained George Schaefer, the president of OPI Cosmetics. Schaefer's Los Angeles-based company is the maker of an almost unnoticeable nail polish that has proved a hit with men. On a larger scale, advertising a physical makeover or a trip to a weight reduction clinic as a smart way to help one in his career seems to help men rationalize their image obsession. Whatever a man's cosmetic shortcoming, it's apt to be a career liability, noted Alan Farnham in a recent issue of Fortune. The business world is prejudiced against the ugly. Obvious rationalization can be seen in Forbes' poor attempt to differentiate between male and female vanity in its article on cosmetic surgery. Plastic surgery is more a cosmetic thing for women. They have a thing about aging. For men, it's an investment that pays pretty good dividend. Whatever you say, guys. The irony is rich and bittersweet. Gender equity is at last headed our way. Not in the form of women being less obsessed with looking like Calvin Klein models, but of men becoming hysterical over the first signs of wrinkles. New words. Affordable. Alienate. Aspiring. Biceps. Bittersweet. Blazer. Bombard. Bulge. Cosmetic. Crippling. Dividend. Elevate. Equity. Financially. Gel. Girly. Greed. Hairline. Handful. Hysterical. insane, insanity, jaw, journalistic, liability, lotion, manicure, manufacturer, moisture, moisturizer, mud, nationwide, pedicure, perpetuate, pot belly, radius, readership, saturated, shortcoming, silken, softener, suitor, toiletries, underdeveloped, underlying, underwear, vanity, whitener.